come here to die, but to fight for the rights of the working man. The small farmer too, protect the proletarian from the bosses and their screws. So hold on to your rifles, boys, don't give up the truth. A republic for the working class, economic.
We're with Larry Kerwin, lead singer, guitarist of Black 47, who just after 25 years on the go, finished up last week. So Larry, what's it like after all these years finishing with the band?
You know, I don't think it's totally sunk in yet, because as soon as the last gig was over, which was last Saturday night, I got ready to come to Ireland. I took a group of people over and then did a solo show in Wexford last night. So I think when I get back to New York, I'll be able to process the thing more. But in a certain way, it's a relief, not from the band's point of view, but just the responsibility of it being at the center of the cyclone of Black 47 for 25 years, and also having to do all the managing part of it, which you're dealing with the music business, and that can get kind of trying, and there's always a state of tension with that, because you're okaying dates or not okaying them, and you're dealing a lot with the affairs of the band. But just to be outside it, I'm actually able to look back a little bit more at it, even in the last week, and that part of it is good. The name was from 1847, the worst year of the Irish potato famine, and when Chris Byrne and I formed the band, the idea was to have a political name or something that would evoke a great crisis and to be overtly political. So there was nothing as strong as that's happened to the Irish people as the potato famine. So that was the basis of the name for us.
One of the things about the band was obviously your politics, like where you never shied away from your politics. You're also great musicians, also very entertaining and great fun. Do you think if you had to put the politics to the background a bit, you could have been a millionaire now?
Yeah. Oh, we were told over and over. But, you know, I always said, what would that make us, a bad-looking Coors? Yeah. That's the way I looked at it. I mean, it's almost like the Yeats line, was there another Troy for them to burn? We were political right from the start. It wasn't that we just were musicians and then decided, oh, let's have a go at being a political band. Chris Byrne and I were both very political and formed the band to be political. I remember the very first night we met and talked about it, the big issue was the Clash was gone, Bob Marley was dead, and the situation in the North was really bad at the time. It was late 1989, and we really felt there was a need for a band that would put politics, and particularly the situation in the North, on the front burner in American life. So yeah, we didn't shy away from it. But I remember when we had the record deal with EMI, I got a call from the EMI office in London, and the big idea was that Black 47 would go there and would be broken into Europe through that. And I got a call from someone saying, you have to stop bombing us. I said, we're not bombing you. But there was an IRA campaign going on at the time. So they put Black 47 as synonymous with the IRA, which we weren't. You know, we were very much involved. But that was the British way at that point, that if you're not against what they're against, then you're against them. And we were tarred with that brush all the time. And we were saying, that's your problem, it's not ours. But by the same token, they put out the albums they had to, and they sold out, and then they wouldn't print anymore, and then we didn't get into Europe because the road to Europe was through London. So we made that decision. No, it wasn't that we were happy with it, but we definitely weren't going to back down from any of the positions we were taking.
Yeah. Probably your most famous song, or your most popular political song, would be James Connolly. You described the first night you've ever played at, the reaction you had. you just tell us what it was like?
Yeah, it was probably the best musical moment I've ever had, because we were playing, we were resident in a little place called Paddy Riley's in New York. And Black 47 never rehearsed. I would bring the songs in and give the members the lead lines, and I would, at that point I was actually programming a drum machine, and the future drummer Thomas Hamlin was playing percussion behind, and we had played together for years, so we had a kind of a symbiotic feeling. So he and I would get together right before the gig, and I would say, this is the drum pattern, and he would get that. And at that point, I think we didn't have a bass player. I was playing bass lines on the electric guitar and playing the electric too. So we're kind of covered with the rhythm section, and then the horn players and the pipe player, Chris Byrne, I would give them the lead lines. And so the idea was we get through the song on this first night, and then we always found that the song jumped 50%. Once you got through it, then you knew you were gonna get through it the second time, and you could, the members could start to put in their own lines. And I remember during the song, especially in the middle of the middle part, which is where you go into the mind of Connolly, the place started to go silent and silent, and it was just totally silent. And when we finished the song, there was still silence, and then there was an eruption, because everyone knew that something new had happened in having that inner dialogue and just capturing Connolly, because I always hated that song, the goddamn Irish Rebel one. It just, to me, it just seemed like that's not Connolly. Yeah, Connolly was this powerful left-wing force. You know, he became more Republican right before the Rising, but you know, he was essentially a left-wing agitator, and we were bringing back the real Connolly into life. And that was, I thought that was a great thing to do, to get back to the truth of Connolly, the character.
Just speaking of Connolly, everybody knows we had a centenary last year about the Dublin 1913 lockout, but of course Wexford had its own lockout, and your family and your friends would have had family memories passed on to them.
You know, even when I was growing up in Wexford in the 60s, the early 60s, there was still a feeling in Wexford about the lockout, who was on what side. There was a lot of bitterness in the town, because it was, you know, Wexford is a small town. Even when I was there, it was, at that period, it was maybe about 12,000 people in it. So you were only one person removed from everyone in the town. You recognized everyone. It was just that perfect size. It was a big town, but you knew everyone. You either knew him to talk to, you knew him to see, or you knew someone who knew everyone else in the town. So there was that residue of the strike that was there. Because the people really suffered. It was an awful winter. They were locked out. And Connolly and Larkin were both down in Wexford, as well as a lot of other leaders of the trade union movement, to keep the people going and to bring support down. But they just didn't have enough financial support, so the suffering was huge, and that was passed down to two generations, into my generation at that point. And people didn't talk about it too much because it was still a sore subject. So now in Wexford, it's gone. You know, the third generation don't really feel it in the same way as we did at that point.
Just speaking of the controversies of the politics in your song, you were uncompromising in 2003 when the Iraq War broke out. Again, you didn't shy away from the politics of that situation.
No, I knew it was a dumb war. I knew exactly what was going to happen with it. And it really pissed me off big time that the ignorance in going forward on one point and the arrogance on another to try and go into another country, no matter how badly it was run, and say, this is the way it should be. It was just really wrong. And I knew that our people were the ones who were going to suffer. It wasn't going to be the Clintons or the Bushes or the senators. They weren't going in, or their children weren't going in. It was going to be the working class and the lower middle class, because the army had stopped being a conscripted army. It was an army of choice. So it was the working class people and the lower middle class who traditionally joined the army, because it was a way forward in life, in that if you did your 3 years, your 5 years, then you got a GI Bill and you were able to go to college, or you were able to get a loan for a house. And people also went into the reserves, because if you went away one weekend a month, you got a certain amount of money, and you were also able to go to college and everything. So it was traditionally a way upwards from the classes. So they were the ones who were going to be sent there. And it was a huge shock to a lot of reservists that they were going to be sent halfway around the world. The idea of a reserve army and a national defense was that you looked after your particular region, and that was it. You know, if something really wrong happened. But now all of a sudden they're being shipped over there, not just for one tour, but for two tours and three tours. So it was like playing Russian roulette. And 2, 3, 4, down, it's a huge virus in the country, because I think it was 2.4 million have served in Iraq, which is a huge proportion of the population. And a lot of them are suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and a lot are really badly injured, because medicine has come along so much that they were able to save a lot of people, but then they're kind of on their own after you're saved and half your head is gone. But I also saw the effects of it, you know, dealing with wounded warriors. I remember one night at a Black 47 gig, because we allowed the veterans were allowed in free into Black 47 gigs, and a guy came in, literally half his face was gone. And he just had tremendous confidence. He started to drink with us and everything. And then during one of the songs, he asked me, could he come up and say a few words? And I said, sure, man. And all of a sudden, the war was in the room. The place was packed. There was a silence, because this guy was hard to look at, and his face was gone. He got up, and he was a bit drunk, and he didn't get off. And I thought, this is perfect. Go ahead, man. Do your thing. And he was up there 5-10 minutes, and he was rambling off. But this was, the war was coming back. And we kind of knew more what was going on than the New York Times or the senators, or because our fans were writing to us and telling us, you know, this is not good over here. This is not going well. They're shooting at us. They won't talk to us. So you could tell early on that the war would not go well. And I always felt it was Black 47's duty as a political band to be out there and doing it, writing songs about it, and being a unifying thing against the war. Even though the Iraq album, if you listen to it, is more about what was going on over there from the point of view of the person serving, rather than a big political statement. So yeah, we just stuck by the guns and did it. But it was pretty uncomfortable, that part, for the first 2-3 years. Every night was the same. Get up there, and there's going to be a fight.
Yeah. I don't want to stick on the controversy, so just one more question.
Sure. I think it's important, because, you know, rock music and rap music, I totally got sickened at the whole thing, because here was something that was going on that wasn't being dealt with. You know, we were one of the few that was dealing with it on a day-to-day basis, and it seemed like a total cop-out, and it kind of turned me against rock music, to tell you the truth.
I was going to ask you about Danny Boy.
Another big one.
How for people who don't know it, you might explain what the song is, but how controversial was that when it came out?
It was huge. The song, well, there was a controversy going on in New York, which is going on to this day, when I wrote the song 20 years ago. I wrote it, I think, in 1994. Anyway, it was recorded in 1994. Maybe I wrote it in 1993. There was the issue of ILGO, Irish Lesbian and Gay Organization, marching the St. Patrick's Day parade. And I knew a lot of the ILGO people, and we did benefits for them. And, you know, it never occurred to me that 20 years later they still wouldn't be allowed in the parade. I thought, you know, maybe 5-10 years of a struggle and it'll get sorted out. So I wrote this song about, it was, some of it was real and some of it was put together. It was about a gay construction worker, but he's a tough guy. And set it to the melody. It was a rap kind of, but it was set, the motif of the Danny Boy melody was there, and the guy was called Danny. And Danny eventually died from AIDS in the song. But what I was doing was getting this juxtaposition of the beautiful Danny Boy melody with the story of a hard guy who happened to be gay. And, you know, he could deal with his gayness, but he couldn't deal with you calling him a faggot. And in the course of the song, the foreman on the site, he's a construction worker, calls him that, and he splits him from his jaw to his ear with a 2x4. What the effect it had, had a number of effects. A lot of people were outraged with the whole idea of using the melody Danny Boy to bring up a subject like that. But I did it on purpose. I knew what I was doing with it. And then a lot of Irish promoters just couldn't handle it. They would ask me not to play it, and then I'd have to play it then. So then they stopped doing that. But the big effect it had was on Irish American youth, who for the first time had to deal with the fact that here is a gay issue, but he's not the gay you're traditionally led to believe that you can go up and beat up on the streets. You know, you have to deal with the fact that this guy might have a 2x4 and go right after you or come looking for you if he hears you've said anything. And the fact that Black 47 was so popular with Irish American youth made them think for the first time, well, you know, Black 47 are okay with this. Maybe it's something I should think about. And it caused a sea change in Irish American attitudes towards gay and lesbian people. I mean, you'd probably need to write another one right now, because, you know, you can only get so long out of that, and attitudes get hardened again. But it did make a huge difference at the time.
Apart from the band, you're also an author and a playwright. Do you want to just say a few words about the other work you're doing, and possibly what you may want to do next when you have it, when you have a rest?
No rest for the wicked. Yeah, you know, I always wanted to be a writer and a playwright too. And one of the great things about being in a rock band is that there's a huge amount of time, because there's a lot of waiting around. And you can use that time, the waiting around, as many of us have done, to go crazy on alcohol and drugs and whatever, because it's ever present there. Especially the alcohol, is you're getting it free, you know, and everyone wants to buy you a drink, so you either slip into that side of things, which many of us have done, or you fight against that and you go back to your room and you write, or you do something with your spare time. So that's what I was able to do. I've been able to write books and plays and musicals over the last 25 years. I had been in a band that had a record deal up until the mid 80s, and, you know, a new wave pop band, and got dropped at a record company and decided to give up music totally for 4 years until we formed Black 47. So I had those 4 years to get a real solid basis in playwriting and in theatre in general. So I'll continue to write for the theatre, and I have a new book that'll be coming out pretty soon called A History of Irish Music as I've Seen It, you know, dealing with the different bands and musical influences that I've had, say, from the 60s right through till today. It's a very subjective look at the history of Irish music. And I also have a musical called Hard Times that's getting developed for supposedly a Broadway run. And that deals with the music of Stephen Foster and how to reimagine it, and the issue of the draft riots in New York City in 1863 when the Irish people and the African Americans went at it. And I've always been interested in that clash and in the things that Irish people and African Americans have in common. So yeah, I'll be writing books and plays, and I'm never going to form another band, but I'm really interested in the whole idea of how do you combine the theater and modern music, rock music, pop music, and folk music. And I was trying to do that a little bit. The first experiment was in Wexford last night, and trying to weave the storytelling into the songs. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, I was there in Wexford last night, yeah, a natural born storyteller, I have to say, so that should be successful.
Yeah, I hope so.
You're president of the Irish American Writers Group this year. Just a couple of significant anniversaries this year in terms of writers, Irish writers, two iconic Dublin writers, Brendan Behan and Sean O'Casey, both died 50 years ago. How would you judge their work, and how are they perceived in the Irish American literary community?
Well, O'Casey is a god in Irish America, and he's a god in theater, in American theater in general, although he's not at one of his heights at the moment, but that's just a matter of you know, you come into favor and you go out of favor, and then someone does a great production of one of your plays. But he's actually on the way back, because the Irish Rep did a great production of The Plough and the Stars recently. So that side of O'Casey is going to come back. I think he's great. I mean, he's the first person who took the real Ireland and put it on stage, and put it on stage at a time of great conflict, of the War of Independence, and probably even more importantly, the great forgotten Civil War, you know. So to me, he's powerful. He does tend to come a little melodramatic now, so you know, just watching or reading the plays, there's a certain amount of melodrama in there, which is not a bad thing, but you can get a little bit on the sentimental side with them, and you got to watch that all the time with them. But that's just the nature of the times and everything. So I think once directors get past that, he'll have a lot to say about modern life and about how we deal with politics and the clash between personality and politics. So I think O'Casey is safe. he's there. Brendan Behan is a magical figure to many of us, because he was the first modern person that was real, that we could relate to, that went out into society and went into the theater. He was one of us, you know. He wasn't an academic. He was someone who worked and wrote about what he saw, and wrote beautifully. And you know, if you look at Behan, you can see his influence. Like, say, Shane McGowan, you could tell that Shane, I wouldn't say copied him, but got a huge influence from him, in the same way that many singer-songwriters in America get an influence from Bob Dylan. You know, you can tell it. And I was definitely influenced by Brendan Behan too, although it's probably not as apparent. But I suppose because Shane took part of his personality to the working class person, although he wasn't working class. But you know what I'm saying? He adopted part of Behan's personality. The problem with Behan, though, too, is, and I'm always surprised that his work has not been brought back, but there's not much of it, is the thing, you know, and that's the real problem with it, and how to bring it back. And he's become much more of a legend than the writer, you know. O'Casey, you always go back to the work with O'Casey, but you don't with Behan, you know, and that's unfortunate that the alcoholism came into effect. As I was telling you before this, I was really close to getting started on a musical about Brendan Behan, but dealing with his alcoholism is just such a huge thing, because for me anyway, because alcoholism is all around you in the in the music world, and it's been in my family, and it's been with so many of my friends and everything. The thought of jumping back into a whole alcoholism thing was like, I'm not ready for this. But I think I will do something with him at some point, but deal more with the real vibrant being, the person from the 50s before he succumbed. Because the more I watch Behan and study him, he was the first person to deal with the fame thing. Him and Dylan Thomas, that idea of fame and how it, how celebrity messes with creativity. And I think Behan, just, you know, coming from a kind of a deprived background, the idea that people wanted to talk about him was so big for him, and in the end it killed him. I would say Steve Earle and Springsteen are both great political songwriters. You know, it's not easy to be a political songwriter, because you can tend to preach, you know. So the only way I've ever seen around it is to use characters to tell the stories. But it's very easy in political songwriting to get preachy, and then who wants to be preached to? It drives you nuts after a while. Joe Strummer was very political. He was a good friend of mine, and Joe's heart was really in the right place. And to be able to write good political songs, I just realized from the three songwriters we were talking about, the three of them, including Joe, had vast encyclopedic ideas about music. They soaked in music, all three of them, Steve Earle, Springsteen, and Joe Strummer. They were continually searching for music too, so that when they did do political songs, they had a lot of foundation, musical foundation, and they tended not to preach because of that, because they were as interested in the song structure and different rhythms and different influences from other countries as they were in getting the message across. And that seems to be really a part of being a vibrant political songwriter, because it's very easy to get preachy. I know. I have to. Well, you have to watch it continually. You can veer over to it. It's almost like the Yeats line, which I use all the time. Yeats's advice is that, well, not advice, but his axiom or whatever, was that poetry should be as cold and passionate as the dawn, meaning that you have to find the center. You know, if you are writing a sentimental song, you have to put some steel into it to bring it back over to the center. And if you're writing a very steely song, you have to put some sentiment into it to bring it back. And that was the point I was making about those three songwriters, that they used the music as a great base to hold down the political stuff so that they don't sound preachy. And that's I have to watch that all the time myself too, you know, and bring in different forms. That's why I think Black 47 used so many different genres of music, from jazz and hip hop and reggae, because it was that constant thing. If you're going to say something that's out there, you better make it interesting with the music underneath it, you know, or you're going to float away.
And then just before we finish, when you arrived back in Wexford yesterday, you got to see a little bit of the current Irish political situation.
Yeah.
You're obviously keeping up to date with what's happening in Ireland.
Yeah, you know, one thing that really struck me about it, apart from the how vibrant it is whenever Fine Gael get in government, they do something like that. In the grand course of things, it's not that this tax is so big, it's just that they know how to break the camel's back, the Fine Gael party does, when it gets in power, with their insensitivity to the people out there. That's just one part of it. The second part is, I think it's great because it's getting people involved in politics and getting them to really question politicians. Because we Irish are great at saying, this politician, I hate him. And yet at the same time, you go out and you'll vote for him again, or you'll vote for that party. This looks to me like that it's going to be the second big turmoil, the first one being with the financial crisis when the Fianna Fáil party got pretty much wiped out, although it's on its way back again. And now it's going to be a further upsurge of questioning every party, you know, which I think is great. It's a really good thing for a democracy to reinvent itself. Democracy shouldn't be stayed, and it shouldn't be just about voting. It should be about people's lives and the people's economic future. So the fact we were driving, the two busloads of us, and all of a sudden we have to stop and they're coming by, and I'm sitting in the front and I see so many of my old friends and everything there with banners, and I was thinking, yeah, you know, the last time I saw you guys, you were in the pub and you were definitely talking politics, but now you're out on the street with this. This is a great thing. I hope it keeps reinvigorating the political process here in Ireland, because I wish it would spread to the U.S. because the U.S. is like tight as a fist with two dumb political parties who are just totally run by money and are so right of center, both of them, that were threatening to topple into the ocean and float off to Iceland, you know, in the U.S. So, yeah, let's import it to the U.S., I would say.
That's a good positive note to end on. Just anything else you'd like to say before we finish?
No, it's just great to be back in Ireland. Great to be back and being a little part of the process. It was great playing last night and being able to put some points of view across to the audience and through music. That's 'cause music is one really easy way to stir things up, because everybody likes music to some degree, and you know, you need more of the Christy Moores over here, you know, the way Christy was in the 60s, 70s and 80s. I'm not sure what Christy could be, a total revolutionary again, as far as I know at this point, but you know what I'm saying is that you need more of that here, you know. Rock music and folk music, rap music, all of it is just too much pie in the sky. It's not dealing with people's issues, and that's what I hope to continue to deal with in whatever career I have post Black 47. Jack's pants straight, brace to
the Lord Jesus Christ every night. I got a homie in Samara going up the walls. Every time he hears an Islamic prayer call, me, I don't care much about Jesus or Muhammad. You don't stop bullets to the best of my knowledge. Little from the boat you catch you in eternity. Hopefully, towards the end of the century. I didn't want to come here, I didn't get to choose. I got the 1, 2, 3, 4 downtown Baghdad blues. I wish I was back home rooting for the Padres. Set the step on Boris on Lucia Sadra. Wish I